This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. Welcome to this hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Bill Buford. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and was the fiction editor of the magazine from April of 1995 through December of 2002. And a couple of years ago, he set out to do a profile for the magazine of New York chef Mario Batali. And early on in that process, he asked himself a question. He asked, could I make it as a restaurant cook? And the result of that process is recorded in a newly published book, which is just out now. It's a book I think should fascinate anyone who likes to cook or is fascinated by the restaurant world, or maybe both. The title of the book is Heat, and it has a rather long subtitle, An Amateur's Adventures as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante-quoting Butcher in Tuscany. The book is published by Knopf, and it's just recently out. And our guest, Bill Buford, will talk about it here with us in this part of Focus 580, and we're pleased to have him. Just a little bit more about him. He came to The New Yorker from Granta, which he edited for 16 years. He's the author of another book titled Among the Thugs, which was published by W.W. Norton back in 92, a highly personal nonfiction account of crowd violence and British soccer hooliganism that's been translated into 10 languages. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions, comments from people who are listening are welcome. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're certainly welcome to join the conversation. Mr. Buford, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. Working in a restaurant kitchen is very hard work. It is hot. It is stressful. You spend long hours on your feet. You get burned. You get cut. It is intensely political. You knew all of that going into this, right?
I knew broadly that, probably about as much as you do, but I don't think I knew how extremely it was a version of all those qualities, and probably the most intense one. Well, actually, just about all of them. I was about to say the most intense of them all was the heat. And my first night in the Babbo kitchen, which is the kitchen run by Mario Batali and his partner Joe Bastianich in Manhattan, I was helping plate dishes, and all the line cooks and their cookers and flat tops and burners and ovens and grills were all against the wall. And I inched over to look at how a plate was being put together and was hit by what felt like an invisible wall of heat. It was just astonishing. And at that moment, I thought, whoa, I don't want to go there in a hurry. But well, in the end, I spent actually, the best part of a year back there on the other side of the wall.
That's I'm sure that a lot of people say this. Reviewers make reference to it that you should have known better. You had a pretty good idea what it would be like, and yet you decided to plunge into it anyway.
It's true. I mean, and the reasons were manifold. I mean, In the beginning, one was just very simple. I was writing a profile of Mario Batali, and I thought it would be interesting to write him sort of from the kitchen out. But the truth is, I've always wanted a cook's knowledge. I was a fundamentally keen, enthusiastic, and ultimately clueless home cook. A very familiar spectacle for my friends when they were invited over to dinner, if they had the misfortune of arriving on time, would be a grease fire and a fire alarm going, and all, you know, I'd just be in a huge sweat, not having bathed for 3 days. And I wanted what cooks know. They had a kind of command and authority and an encyclopedic knowledge of food that I wanted. And I guess I just wanted to see if I could do it. It was obviously very difficult, but it was. So many of us have an interest in cooking, and we've all sort of wondered if we could actually survive in a kitchen. So it was a challenge, and it was a kind of knowledge that I wanted to have.
Yeah. Well, I really should say though that I understand the impulse completely. If I had the opportunity to do the same, I think I might do it. Although I would be filled with trepidation, to say the very least. Right at
the start, I was filled with trepidation and excitement. I mean, I proposed it to Mario. Mario had come over for dinner. He wasn't a friend at that time. He was a friend of a friend, and was such a spectacle of excess and bad behavior, and such a devotee to fat and taste and alcohol, boasting on that occasion that he and his business partner Joe Bastianich regularly drink a case of wine when they go out to dinner in Italy. Just the thought of drinking a case of wine over dinner, it resulted in my proposing that the New Yorker run a profile of him, and the editor, in his wisdom or bad judgment, decided that I should be the person to write it. And I mentioned that to Mario and said that I wanted to, you know, write the profile, and he said yes, and you know, the New Yorker wants to write it, and he said yes, and but I want to work in his kitchen, and he said, I'm not so sure about that. And it was all based on the assumption that I wouldn't mess up too much. And my first morning in the kitchen, I was full of excitement. It was something I'd been wanting to do for years. I'd always thought at some point I'd befriend some chef, and he'd let me come in on Saturday and chop his vegetables, something like that. And I was from the first hours, I was quickly abused of any naive notions that I had when I ended up making just about a mess of everything, including myself, failing to arrive with knives. I didn't know you were meant to arrive with knives. Failing to arrive with a marker pan. I had no idea you were meant to arrive with a marker pan. And borrowing somebody's knife, which was a little unwieldy in my hand. And well, I've been given the task of boning ducks. No idea how you're meant to bone a duck. And ended up very delicately but deeply dragging this foreign knife across the top of my finger from the back of the fingernail right across the knuckle, erupting in a great messy gush. And from that moment on, I realized I was in for a new experience.
New York is a big restaurant town, so it would not be surprising that someone like Mario would become a celebrity in that world. Mario has become a national celebrity and is part of this wave now of enthusiasm that's been going on probably for a couple of years, enthusiasm for cooks and for cooking. The Food Network on television has had something to do with that, but I think it's somehow more than that. What do you think it is that has happened that has made so many people get excited about cooking and in the process has made people like Mario Batali superstars?
Television certainly has helped. And I think television is a big magnifying glass about something that is going on in any case. Friends of mine have observed that, you know, decades hence, people look at this time as a time when the only things that mattered were movies and chefs, or at least movie stars and chefs, and maybe movie stars, their babies and chefs. Having said that, I think a lot of cultures have gone through cycles, going all the way back to the beginning of the 19th century in France, and probably before that, when food has suddenly mattered in a powerful way. In fact, very definitely, you can go back to even the Italian Renaissance when the Medicis were holding sway and grand banquets were the kind of three-star restaurants of the day. And everybody talked food, wrote food, published books about food. Some of the best books about food, in fact, were published then. We're definitely at a time in the cycle when food is of interest to us. And I think that partly is in the nature of food. I've come to think of it as it has a kind of charisma. It's always on the verge of meaning. It's always on the verge of having lots of different meanings and never quite having them. It's always on the verge of meaning. It's an art. And throughout the history of food, going back to Roman times, they've referred to it as the art of cooking. It's a skill. It's essential for our nutrition. It expresses history. It expresses nationalism. It expresses identity. It expresses our childhood. It expresses family. It expresses all these powerful things, and yet, at the end of the day, it's dinner. And at the end of the day, it doesn't mean any of these things because finally you eat it and it's gone. I sometimes also wonder if this particular cycle in the excitement surrounding food is maybe a result of our ignorance. And I think there would be no time in human history when a population was as ignorant about food as ours is today. We're a supermarket. We're not the supermarket generation. We're the generation after the supermarket generation. I think we're so many removes from how food is made that we come to these things with a profound ignorance. And a lot of what I was doing in going to the kitchen was I was driven by my ignorance. I didn't know how to cook meat in any kind of reliable way. And I didn't, there were a lot of vegetables. I didn't know what to do with them. And I mean, not even sort of fancy things like how to make fancy filled ravioli and cook them in sort of exquisite ragouts and all the combinations and things that I ultimately learned. It was just very, it was a very elementary knowledge that I wanted in the kitchen. And so much of my time in the kitchen was spent looking left, looking right, looking at what else someone else was doing, going, oh, that's how you do it. Oh, that's what you do with dandelion greens, or, you know, that's what you do with, that's one of the things you can do with fennel, and really basic knowledge.
Yeah. Well, do you think that it to learn, it, you really, in spite of the fact that probably there are a lot of good instructional aids and there are so many cookbooks now, that you really have to cook alongside someone and watch them do it and have them show you how to do it to really learn?
I don't think you have to do that to really learn, but I think you certainly learn more. And I think that's in the nature of what it is you're learning. You know, so much of our education has always been book supported by something else. And, you know, I saw someone in the street today with a chemistry textbook, and I was thinking of the nature of a book. You know, we read a book and it's gone, but certain books you have for 6 months or a year or 2 years. I was thinking of my How to Learn Italian book, and it was a book that I had for 2 years, but it was supported with all this classroom time and tapes and speaking. And there's a whole other dimension to learning, which is over and above the book, and that is no more the case than in cooking. And my cooking really had all been book learned, apart from seeing some friends who were better cooks than I was and seeing how they did things. It was all a kind of deductive education. Read a page, maybe do a compare and contrast with someone else who has a similar preparation and maybe someone else, and that was how I would then go about a dish. But in a kitchen, there's no books. There is a big, at the Babel Kitchen, there was a thing called the Bible, which is a big blue spiral notebook where every recipe was recorded, which I only came across after I'd been there about 6 months, and it was almost never referred to until some other special was being invoked that had been made years before. Everything else is visually learned, and you're standing next to people who are showing you how to do it, and it's all eyes and hands. And cooking is, in fact, all eyes and hands and the senses and smell and touch and taste. And it's it is probably one of the most sense-driven activities in normal humankind. And to learn these things in the kitchen is probably to learn them closer to the sort of the primary experience of what it is to cook.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus, Bill Buford. He's staff writer from The New Yorker. He was the fiction editor at the magazine for 8 years, and he is the author of this book that recounts his experiences, a lot of it his experiences working in the kitchen of Babbo, the restaurant, one of the restaurants in New York that's run by Mario Batali. The book is Heat. That's the title. It's published by Knopf. It is out now. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. As I said at the beginning, one of the things about restaurant kitchens is that they are intensely hierarchical, political places. How did the staff at Babbo react to you when you first showed up?
Well, when I first showed up, I was, I mean, no one really knew what to make of me. I was Mario's, they saw me as Mario's friend, but I was filling a slot. I hadn't known this, but I was filling a slot which pre-existed, which was the slot in the kitchen for an extern. An extern is the term for students who are completing an education at a cooking school and get their degree. They have to do 3 to 6 months in a professional kitchen. And restaurants come to depend on them a little bit. It's kind of free labor. It's free eager labor, and the free eager labor gets a great education. So there was a slot, and they didn't really, you know, they kind of helped me along and were very supportive. When the piece appeared, and when it was done, I felt there was much more that I could have said, and there was much more I wanted to do, and I decided I'd go back into the kitchen and see if I could be there long enough to get a book out of the experience. When I went back into the kitchen, that was very different. One, because I'd written this piece, and they realized how much a journalist observes, and I think they're a little alarmed by that. So they're very wary in the beginning. And they got over that wariness when I showed that I was going to do all the labor to be a member of the kitchen staff. And then I was made to climb up the hierarchy. I was a kitchen, I don't know if I'm allowed to say the word on radio. I was a kitchen, am I allowed to say the word? I was a kitchen female mongrel. I was
yeah, best to be on the safe side these days, yeah.
I was a kitchen female mongrel, and I was treated as such. It's a very small kitchen, and some sense of my status was discovered by me when I mentioned in passing to Mario that the kitchen was very small, and I seemed to be bumped by a lot of people, and he said, they bump you because they know they can. And the next day I counted, I was bumped 48 times in the course of the day. Someone walking past me, they just a little loose with the hips, and they get a little swing and bump my butt. I was the lowest of the low, and I had to climb my way up and prove myself.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's one place in the book where you recount this exchange between Mario and somebody else at the restaurant, and that guy had bumped Mario, and Mario said, "Don't bump me." And he went on to say, "Look, this is my place. I own everything here. Nobody bumps me." So he is obviously the guy who's at the very top.
Yes, that was poor Dominic. He actually retreated to the walk-in and said, "You know, Mario's at my station. I can't move without running into them. I'm just hiding here until he leaves." there's a very, very clear hierarchy in the kitchen. And in a traditional kitchen, you know, the head chef, someone like Mario, is not even referred to by name. He's called chef. Mm-hmm. And then you have your executive chefs, your sous chefs, and they're allowed to put chef on their jackets. And they, too, are called chefs. And then it goes down, and you're a cook, if you're able to be a line cook. And then it goes a little bit further down until you're that female mongrel animal. Or else you're just designated by your duties, like you're the chickpea guy, or you're the washing up guy, or you're the white shirt guy.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with a caller here. We have somebody who's want to join the conversation here in Charleston, not all that far away, on line number one. Hello.
Hi, I'm really enjoying your conversation. What do you think of Hell's Kitchen on TV?
Which is that, Gordon Ramsay's?
Yes.
You know, I've only seen it once. I watched so much television, watching Mario on television to write this book. I concluded I watched 450 hours of multiple Mario. That I got a surfeit of cooking television. But the Gordon Ramsay is interesting because Gordon Ramsay himself is such a interesting figure. And the background for it, I know, is a fly-on-the-wall piece of television journalism that a British television crew did, in which it showed Gordon Ramsay opening up a new restaurant and featured a moment when Gordon Ramsay actually beat his maitre d' over the head in front of the camera. I mean, you haven't seen a more profoundly profane individual on television in your life. So he's now playing a little bit of a caricature. He's playing the caricature of the hard guy, but it is sort of the hard guy kitchen.
That's not hubris. I mean, he really is that way. I mean, I'm just astounded that a labor of love, when people really love to cook, and then they have to put up with somebody who's just screaming at them. You know,
there are clearly two schools of chefs. There's there's the non-screamers and the screamers, and there's no question where Gordon Ramsay falls. And Mario Batali trained initially with Marco Pierre White. Marco Pierre White is an English chef who's an absolute screamer. But Gordon Ramsay also trained, and Mario, as a result, is not a screamer. Gordon Ramsay first trained in Marco Pierre White's kitchen, and Gordon is clearly a screamer. A lot of it comes out of the fact, an observation that Tony Bourdain made, that you know, when you're in a kitchen, it's all about domination. The point was, what do chefs like to do after when they go out to dinner? And it says what you spend the whole evening, you're trying to dominate time, schedule, individuals, incompetence, mistake, ingredients, customers. It's all about making the thing work, which is partly why you have this military hierarchy. And then, of course, when they go out to dinner, the last thing they want is to do anything. They want submission, and they want someone to cook for them.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, it is the most unlikely work environment in modern society. There's just nothing else like it.
Yeah, well, I just think it's a wonderful thing to be able to cook, but I don't know about that process of into the frying pan. That's just, crazy.
Yeah, and one of the great virtues of home cooking is that you don't have to have Gordon Ramsay over for dinner.
Exactly. Just that people are eating your food. Well, I'm really enjoying it. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for the call. It makes me think of a story that I read a long time ago about a story that Pierre Franey told about when he was a young man. He was learning and he was working in a restaurant kitchen, and there was someone It was not the lead chef, but someone who was really sort of in charge of running things. And he was a famous tyrant, and he had a huge wooden spoon. And if you did something wrong, he'd hit you with it. And Franey talked about how at one point he had made an omelet and it had a wrinkle. And so this guy was going to whack him with a spoon, or maybe he did whack him with a spoon, and Pierre just had it by that point. And I don't know how old he was, 15 or 17 or 18, and he threw the omelet at the guy. And apparently the man who owned the restaurant, instead of being outraged, he thought this was a great heroic act and decided that Pierre should be the one to marry his daughter and carry on the tradition of running the restaurant. And apparently Pierre said, well, I wasn't so sure about that, and he went off to America. But it was one of those stories that makes you think that there is this classic sort of tyranny that reigns in so many kitchens, and that it's an institutionalized tyranny that it may indeed be passed on from one generation to the next.
And I guess it's the stamina and difficulty of service, but there is no other work environment like that in a modern urban setting. To go, say, from the New Yorker, which is where I was at the beginning, I was still working as an editor, where I had my civilian job and I wore a tie to work and, talked in hush-hush tones about misplaced modifiers, to take the subway down and go into this world in the kitchen, and I'd change in the basement with all the Mexican prep chefs who are finishing for the day, and then go into this box, and then you go through the swing door, and it's like you've left the public. And you've left all the public rules, and you've left all the civilities, you've left the whole notion of political correctness and courtesy into a kitchen where it's rude and aggressive and abrasive and politically incorrect and racist and coarse and difficult and physical and hot, and I loved it.
Hmm. One of the things that I have always wondered about people who cook for a living is, having spent the entire day or maybe the entire night or whatever it is doing that on their feet cooking for other people, when they get home, do they cook? Do these people cook
almost
at home?
Almost never. That interested me as well. Almost never. I just finished a piece for the New Yorker on a pastry chef, Will Goldfarb, who runs a restaurant which serves only dessert. And I asked him what he has in his fridge, and he's got some yogurt for the baby, and that's it. Frankie, one of the chefs at Babbo, doesn't have any food in his fridge. The only thing he gets, he said, it arrives by bicycle, and that would be a pizza. They eat in the restaurant. They eat in the kitchen. They serve food for themselves. It's usually eaten standing up, and sometimes they'll go out to a restaurant afterwards, although they usually go out to drink. But it's, no, there's almost no preparation at home.
There's
no busman's holiday.
What is the relationship between, and I expect that probably the answer is it's something of a love-hate relationship, between the staff and the patrons?
That's very interesting, too. In a way, it's a non-relationship. You really are, not only are you sealed off from the rest of society, in a way, you're sealed off from the people you're making food for. There are people, it's a tremendous divide. They don't come into the kitchen, you don't go into the dining room. People do, the head chef does, and it's, someone like Mario, it's his great skill that he can be very comfortably in both worlds. He's different people in both worlds. He's a different person in the kitchen from what he is when he's sitting at the bar in his own restaurant and everybody's coming up and wanting to touch him because he's the celebrity Mario Batali. When he's in the kitchen, he does transform into something else, and I think he actually is much more comfortable in the kitchen. But for most people, they're not making a lot of money, and there is no way they could, they couldn't really afford to eat at Babbo, except that if they're serious cooks, they would figure out a way to eat at Babbo, and a lot of them will have eaten at Babbo before they started there because they're serious cooks. But it's not an they're not making that much money, so they're making food that really they couldn't afford to eat themselves for people who have much more money than they'll probably ever have in their life. And it's just two worlds that don't touch. Mm. They just don't touch.
There, you touch on what I think is an interesting point, and that is that while we know that there are a lot of people who are drawn to this work and find it thrilling, and once they're in that world, maybe they would say, "I wouldn't do anything else." It actually doesn't pay very well. If you're Mario, you'll do okay. But that an awful lot of the people who work for him and a lot of other places, big time restaurants, it's just not a great living.
It's not a great living. The hope, I think, for most people in the kitchen is that they're going to do. It's going to take them 10 years to find out if they've got what it takes to be either a head chef or someone who can run his or her own restaurant. And it probably does take 10 years. One of the things I was trying to describe in the book was, I was telling my story, obviously, but I was also telling Mario's story and the stories of other cooks. And Mario's story is actually a long story. It's 10 to 15 years in the wilderness before finally he's able to run a restaurant that he's either not going to get fired from or where he's actually going to make a living. And everybody in the restaurant is going through that kind of education. It put me in mind really more of writers or actors where people had to, you know, they got paid what they had to get paid because they knew this was part of their education. And a lot of people there were explicitly, they were working in a Babbo kitchen because they wanted to learn what Mario had to offer and what his style of preparation was and what Italian food was. And then they were moving on. One of the sort of extra pleasures for me of having worked in the kitchen and living in a restaurant city like New York, I mean, Chicago is another restaurant city, and there's plenty of restaurant cities around America, but one of the virtues of being in New York is that I now run into these chefs as they go on to other places. So one guy who I worked alongside in the Babbo kitchen is now in the John George kitchen, which is it's like a four-star French establishment, and another guy is doing another kind of European cooking, and he's the head chef over there, and another guy has now gone off to do Latin American cooking, and it's all part of the, one guy has gone off to Italy, another person's gone off to Italy, it was one stage in everybody's education, and they're not being paid a lot of money, but they're also assuming that 10 years down the line, it will be different for them.
Yeah, and we talked about how intense the work was in the kitchen and how stressful. I guess, too, you have to acknowledge that, particularly in a place like New York, but, maybe everywhere, because it's a hard business and it's a hard business to succeed in, particularly in a place, though, in New York, to maintain a reputation in a place where there are so many restaurants and new ones opening all the time and other ones going out of business, to just hold your own is really, as an establishment, is really very tough. So that would mean that every night, the way you look at it, I suppose, is every night is make or break, and then you might even elevate it to the point where you say every plate is make or break.
It's certainly a very, it's not a place where you can get lazy. And that's reinforced by the fact that in any big city, if you get a reputation, there's going to be people out there to knock you down. The informing fear of the Babbo kitchen was at any moment the New York Times restaurant critic was going to revisit the establishment. It had got 3 stars when Ruth Reichel was the restaurant critic for the New York Times. When William Grimes took over, they were convinced he was going to sneak in clandestinely and review them again. He didn't. When he left, there was another restaurant critic, but she didn't last. And sure enough, with the next restaurant critic, Frank Bruni, he did sneak in, and Babbo was the first restaurant that he reviewed and threw the whole establishment into a panic. Because as it happened, it coincided with a time when the executive chef who'd been there for years and years had left. There was a new chef. He has a difficult personality. Many people got fired or quit. And usually Mario, who doesn't have to be in the Babbo kitchen that much anymore, was having to be there all the time. And as a result, the restaurant critic, without his realizing it, was getting a glimpse of Babbo being run in a way that it normally isn't. Mario was just there all the time because the kitchen was on the verge of veering out of control. But in the end, they were they were well acquitted.
Let's talk with another caller here, someone in Urbana where we are, line one.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I have two questions. And the first question is, I think that traditionally cooking is, in the United States, is a woman's work and kind of ignored woman's work, right? And then you have this sort of really high-level chefs in the kitchen, very competitive and kind of like stars, right? And I think that it's not a very female culture in the kitchen, isn't it, in these restaurants? And I was wondering if you could explain that, you know, if you had a feeling about why those places aren't very female-friendly. And then the other question I had is that when you describe the attitudes in the kitchens, it appears to be quite abusive. And you know, you said that you love it. You love that it's racist, and you love that it's politically incorrect. And I'm just wondering how come that's okay in that space to you? Do you know what I mean? Where it might not be okay in other spaces. And I'm going to hang up and listen. Okay?
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Those are two very interesting questions. The first is interesting because certainly in American home cooking, most of the cooking conventionally has been done by women. That might be changing now. The view in an Italian restaurant is one that would seem to resist scientific scrutiny, but it's that women make the best cooks. And Mario is convinced that women make the best cooks. The prep chef is a woman, Elisa Sarno, and most of the food is really prepared during the day, and then it's sort of assembled at night. It's not all of the food, but a lot of the food is prepared during the day, and that's done under Elisa's watch. And Mario's convinced that she makes better food because she's a woman. Joe Bastianich, his business partner, shares the same view. It's also an Italian view. And in Italy, where actually most people believe that the best dinner they will ever have is prepared by their mother, all the cooks are variations of your mother. And when you go to Italy, it's the man in the front of the house who's the maitre d' and telling you what wine that you should drink and taking your order, and it's a woman in the kitchen. And they're great women cooks in Italy. But having said that, it is weirdly dominated by men right now, and it is a pretty aggressive place. And the women who are in the kitchen toughen up and come in often as one thing and stay and make a living by becoming something else, tougher, more traditionally masculine. I'm now forgetting the second bit of the question.
Well, she referred to the things that you said about what the kitchen was
like.
Oh,
the coarseness and the racism.
Yeah. And what? You know, why is that?
I like the hard reality of it. I like the kind of do or die. The whole thing was do or die. It was you're on the line and you can prepare the food and it works, or you get thrown out. You're on the line and everything is prepared correctly, or you're told to go home. And everything about it was just not polite. It was black and white. And if people behave badly in themselves, then under that pressure and in that situation, they're going to behave badly. It doesn't mean that everybody's a racist. I don't think there are. I think there's a lot of very good people in the kitchen. But everybody's worst bits are not hidden. You're with these people working under pressure in heat for 14 hours, and you know everything about them. And if they're coarse, you hear about it. And if they're visiting prostitutes, you hear about it. And if they get excited by someone they think is a prostitute in the corner table, they all go marching out to have a look. It's not pretty, but they're not pretty. On the other hand, there's very just and good and artistic-minded people in the kitchen as well. There's just a kind of nothing hidden about it, and I think that's what I liked. Hmm. There's just no disguises.
I was very struck by something that William Grimes, in fact, wrote when he reviewed your book for the New York Times. He writes, "Mr. Buford carries on the Hemingway tradition in American Letters. Men come to know themselves and achieve transcendence through physical suffering, a quest with strong sadomasochistic overtones." Would you cop to that?
I think that's where Mr. Grimes is trying to be witty.
What, you feel he has failed?
I can't say I read that paragraph and endorsed it with much enthusiasm, but I wasn't entirely convinced he was endorsing with much enthusiasm my book as well. I don't, you know, I wasn't doing this because it was some kind of Hemingway test. I was just doing it because I wanted to learn. I knew, like you said at the beginning of the program, I had an idea, like all of us would have an idea what you're going into the kitchen. But mm-hmm. my main thing was I wanted their knowledge. I was curious to know if I was a good enough cook to sort of handle it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that it was going to be as extreme as it was. But then in the event, I think I was animated by the extremeness. And if that puts me in a Hemingway camp, I don't know. I don't remember reading anything like that in Hemingway, but maybe Mr. Grimes knows his Hemingway better than me.
All right, let's talk with someone else here in Champaign, line one. Hello. Yes.
I just wanted to mention that the sort of vigor in the sort of kitchen is very synonymous to when, you know, my grandma and my mom and my aunt would get together for like maybe a Thanksgiving meal or Christmas dinner or something like that. You know, and you'd want to, as a little boy, I'd want to come in and help. But if I did something wrong, I was kicked out, just automatically. And it took a lot of time to get into the phase where I could do something appropriate and correct so that I would actually be wanted in the kitchen. And I think this notion of sort of this brutalness, sort of, you know, it was shown by my grandma and my mom, you know, in a very casual, you know, family setting even then. So I don't know if it's just sort of me, but I think that the idea of the kitchen is sort of just you have to do it right or it's ruined.
That's a great observation and a great recollection. And it makes me realize, of course, that, you know, what your grandmother and your mother are working with is food. And whatever it is, you have to spend money to get your food. And you don't want to mess it up. It's like throwing away money. Or it becomes a much more precious thing when it involves an animal and you're roasting a bird or you're roasting a piece of meat. And then what you're working with is, you know, an animal which has been sacrificed for your plate. And this is a serious business. It's the serious business of acquiring food that it's your duty to prepare, and it's the serious business of feeding your family, and it's the serious business of preparing, if it's a, you know, one where everybody else is there, for some kind of celebration. And there's a lot of weight on an occasion like that, and I think you're completely right. You know, there's not room to mess it up. You know, you mess up something and you can't fix it. You got to throw it out. It also puts me in mind of an experience I had with when I was learning how to make pasta in Italy. One of the things that I did was at some point I decided that I wanted to learn how to cook like Mario and to undergo a sort of version of his education. And at a very crucial point in his life, he abandoned the United States and he went to Italy to learn how to cook like an Italian and was taught pasta by a woman named Betta in a town between Pistoia and Bologna, between Tuscany and Emilia-Romagna in the mountains. And I went there to learn how to make pasta. And Betta recalls how a sort of a similar convocation to the one that you described, how her most powerful memory of childhood was Christmas, because that's when her mother and her four aunts, a family of five sisters, all gathered round and made tortellini, the little handmade folded kind of ravioli that is a feature of the region and very difficult to make. And one of her, what she did for years, was not get in the way so that she wouldn't mess up and get kicked out of the kitchen. She just watched until when she was 12 years old, she was finally allowed to make the tortellini herself. And it was one of her great achievements, is that she could make this food with her fingers that her aunts made and could join the Christmas convocation.
Yeah, and I was just wanting to mention one more thing on the language, sort of being more vulgar and aggressive. Well, some of the harshest statements my mother and grandma and my aunt would ever say to me was in the kitchen during time of preparation. It's sort of funny that all of a sudden some of the harshest things my family has said to me was during preparation of a meal.
That's fantastic.
So, well, fantastic. Thanks a lot.
The kitchen is where everything is at stake.
Yeah,
I love that.
And it's something that, you know, I love to cook now, and it's, I think, maybe one of the reasons that the male chefs are so dominating is they want to impress their mothers. Well, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for the call.
Bye.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Bill Buford. He is a writer for The New Yorker. He was the fiction editor for 8 years. He was the founding editor of Granta Magazine and also the publisher of Granta Books. And he is the author of this book that's about his experiences, a lot of that in Babbo, in the kitchen of Babbo, Mario Batali's restaurant in New York. The book is titled Heat. And it's published by Knopf. Well, as you explained, you wanted to learn as much as you possibly could about the Italian style of cooking and the approach to cooking. So you spent this time working in Mario's kitchen. You learned a lot of things, and then felt that you really wanted to do what he had done and go to Italy and spend some time there and do more learning. Let me ask you, what is the difference, the fundamental difference between Italian food as people prepare and serve it in Italy and Italian-American food that a lot of Americans would be used to?
Oh, lots of differences, and they're probably now at this point almost completely different traditions. Italian food in Italy is really agrarian cooking, and it arises out of a respect for the ingredients and cooking with the seasons, and it's very highly codified. You're often cooking using a region's preparations as that region has been doing those preparations for many centuries. One of the difficulties that the people who welcome Mario in Italy, Betta and her husband Johnny, had with Mario was that he didn't know how to cook in the style of Bologna. And so in their eyes, he was an incompetent cook. And in their eyes, they taught him everything that he knows, and they're still mystified that he could go on to be such a great success when he's obviously such a bad cook to start with. And not only that, he's not really following the preparations as they should be done because there is only one way to do them. Italian-American cooking comes from a very different tradition, and it's an immigrant cooking tradition, and a lot of the preparations arose out of the fact that you couldn't get ingredients that you would have in Italy. You couldn't get Parmigiano cheese, you couldn't get garlic, you couldn't get pancetta, and also it has a kind of immigrant celebration to it. So there's a huge premium on meat and meat sauces. Pastas, which are rarely freshly made, are often carriers for big meat sauces because meat and meatballs and things like that are a sign of success and affluence and making it a sort of a sign of an immigrant success. Very different in Italy, where a pasta sauce is a ragu, which is a meat and broth or liquid that's been cooked for a very, very long time. So you could just use, so it's almost like stretching out the meat. One's born out of poverty and one's born out of success. Meatballs are born out of success, and an Italian ragu is usually born out of poverty, where you're cooking your leftovers and coming up with a way of making eight other meals with it, and you lightly dress the pasta with it because the pasta is the event, not the sauce, whereas in an Italian-American kitchen, usually it's the sauce that's the event, not the pasta. Mm-hmm.
You talked about the fact that when before all this started, you really liked to cook, and you were a motivated home cook and liked to, even though, you know, maybe things aren't always perfect in the way you like to cook and you like to have people over for food. As a result of the experience of working in the professional kitchen, what would you say really separates, say, a good home cook from a professional?
Professionals usually do less than most home cooks, I think. I mean, it's almost a question of being relaxed. The professional's done the stuff so many times, they don't have to think about it in the same way. It came home to me when I was helping a visitor prepare a birthday dinner for an editor here in New York. And I took her down to the fish market in the middle of the night, and she bought a big fish, which she then cooked. And then in the course of it, I recognized the clams that the Babbo restaurant uses for its linguine alla vongole, and I bought a bunch of clams, and I thought I'd cook a pasta course. And I prepped my ingredients in the way that I'd been taught, and so that when I arrived at 5 or 6 o'clock, all the work was really done, and it was just a matter of putting the dish together, and I'd done it so many times I didn't have to think about it. I was talking to people, and people were gathered around the pan, and I cooked for a dozen people. You know, this isn't the way I would have cooked before, but I cooked for a dozen people without ever having really to think twice about it, because it was all in the muscles and it become all automatic. The cooking itself was very simple. You know, it was noodle and shellfish and a little bit of pancetta. Meanwhile, the other part of the meal, prepared by a very accomplished cook, but not one who'd been working in a kitchen, caught on fire. The smoke alarm went off. The fire department was called in, and it's just almost a level of comfort. Also, you do less, because you know that if you're lucky enough to go to a local green market and get good ingredients, then you know how to prepare those ingredients and let the ingredients do all the work.
Well, I guess it's interesting that it makes me think that if indeed you're cooking something that a dish that you've made 100 times, 200 times, 300. I mean, it could be something that you have done over and over again. Well, first of all, you think by the time you've made it 100 times, you ought to know how to make it, and you ought to be able to make it right, and it ought to be good. But how do you maintain your enthusiasm for that plate of linguine with clams after you've made, plate number 273?
Because it's surprising every time. Because finally, like the caller said with his grandmothers and his mother, finally it's food. And finally it is a composition, and you're dealing with, you know, real ingredients, you know, living shellfish, and participating in a great pasta tradition, and you're putting there's nothing, you know, to my mind, there's few things as satisfying as the very simple thing of making food. And one of the things I liked best about working in the kitchen was that when you finally got it down and you got into rhythm, it wasn't that you're cooking your 200th plate of linguine alla vongole or your 500th plate of lamb chops. It's that you now knew how to make it perfect. And there's something very nice about making a perfect plate of food. And it was deeply satisfying for me to put the plate together and do all the contorni and mount it in just such a way and put some lemon zest on top and put it to the pass so the executive chef would look at it and make sure that it's perfect and then hand it to a runner, and the runner runs it out to a table. And if you could do that 50 times a night, that's 50 little buzzes of perfection of making food. And that's very satisfying for me. And I think that's probably something I've always enjoyed, and probably why I got involved in this whole business in the first place. I just always enjoyed the business of making a plate of food.
One of the things that often separates restaurant food from a good home cooking is what it looks like. And I think I've had the experience of making something I thought tasted pretty good, but somehow I wanted it also to look pretty. It's not enough that it tastes good. I wanted it to look good. What do you, did you learn some things you think about presentation?
Some simple things. It's pretty elementary. You don't put much on the plate. Most plates are too crowded. And if you're making it at home, I mean, one of the things I've discovered is it doesn't mean you can't make other things, but put them on other plates. Put them on side plates. Keep the plate simple. Use symmetry, and then use anti-symmetry. Kind of use asymmetry with your symmetry. And very simple things like simple plate, few ingredients, symmetrically arranged, looks great. And then you do something with very few things, simple plate, symmetrically arranged, and then one little thing is asymmetrical. Or if you do have color elements, you can use the color, but it's very important that if you have color elements, you're using them because there are things you want to eat, not because one's red and one's green. But the more time you spend in the kitchen, and you know, there's little tricks, like you can use squirter bottles with olive oil to put green dots around the plate if you want that, or you can use with balsamic vinegar and use a squirter bottle to make stripes. But that's getting fancy. You don't really need to get fancy. Mainly it's just keep it simple.
I read that you were thinking that you might like to do a project very much like this, the same sort of approach, this time with a French food?
That's true. That's true. We haven't lined up the trip, but this book was really possible because my wife is a fluent Italian speaker. So in the beginning, she was sort of whispering translations in my ear while I was taking classes at Scuola Italiana del Greenwich Village. I did learn Italian by working in a butcher shop, and there's nothing like, you know, being ordered around to really work on your imperative declensions. But she's also a fluent French speaker, so I think we're probably ready to go into a French kitchen. But there's also kind of an ideological motivation, which is that I felt, in the end, I've learned Italian cooking up to a certain point in Italy. They're of the conviction that French cooking started in Italy, and that when Katrina de' Medici in 1533 crossed the Alps and married the future king of France, she took with her all the secrets of Italian cooking. And French ingrates that they are have never thanked the Italians properly. In fact, they don't even credit them. But I actually came to believe this to be true. And it seems like in my education as a cook, the logical next step is to cross the Alps and find probably settle myself in Lyon and follow the trajectory of Katrina de' Medici.
Well, it's a very entertaining story, and I appreciate you giving us some of your time to talk about it.
Been very entertaining for me.
Bill Buford, our guest, he's staff writer from The New Yorker, and the book is Heat, An Amateur's Adventures as a Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante-quoting butcher in Tuscany, just recently out, published by Knopf.